We will get started. I'm going to share my screen. You should see what we have. Let's see. Oh, infant tested positive today. Oh, wow. That's not good. Not good. Well, we are in November. It is election day. And it's one of those things where we just need to keep on trucking no matter what happens, right? So that's why I didn't cancel class or anything crazy like that. I said, you know what? We got to get through all this. So we're going to get through some stuff today. I think it's going to be kind of fun and exciting. We're going to talk about Stuxnet. I was looking over, you know, I do plan. I'm not just kind of willy-nilly haphazard all the time. But I did look over what we have left. And this coming, so today we're going to go over Stuxnet and a little bit more on the critical infrastructure. And then Thursday, I'm going to go into espionage, which is kind of fun, and then talking about the China-US relationship when it comes to cyber. And then next week, since next week is our last week of class, hard to believe, I know, so hopefully you all are registering, because a registration opened up, and I think it's by what, you know, when you graduate and whatnot, but registration is open, so don't forget to do that for next quarter. But next Tuesday, I'm going to talk about Bitcoin, a little bit about cryptocurrency. I should say not just Bitcoin, but on there's different kinds of cryptocurrency, and add in ransomware to that. And then I will go ahead and finish out with Internet of Things and Dark Web on the 12th. So that's where I see us going. And yeah, are there any questions, comments, concerns before I hop in? All right. So what do we have due this week? I have been grading. You probably saw I'm down to just, I have a few more presentations to grade and then I'm pretty much caught up with this class. My other class, I'm a little bit behind. So if you're in the other section of IT 238, I'm just a little bit behind. You did very well on the network diagram. That was easy. You know, I just wanted you to kind of look through that and see if you could pick out some of the key devices on a network. So this week you have cybersecurity companies as an assignment / discussion board, and then a quiz. So not too much this week. More just kind of reading about what's going on. Hopefully the book, you're still reading the textbook and enjoying it. I really think it's a good book. It's a good read. And even though I don't go necessarily lockstep with the book all the time, I still think it's a good book. And some of you may have got it for free. Others, not very expensive. It's like, anyway, I digress. So what are we talking about? Internet bots, election, and what I'm talking about today. So what are these internet bots? You've probably heard of bots, botnets, things like that. Well, bots are programmed to automatically do certain actions, such as crawling web pages, attempt to break into user accounts, and things like that. So bots are out there, these behind the scenes little, you think of these little bots that are just working, you know, like little bugs that are out there that are doing things in your computer that you're typically not aware of. It's really a few lines of code with a database. There's like three parts to it, an API, a database, and then like the script that tells it, you know, what it's going to do. They don't need to be written. They're already written for you. There's just little scripts out there that Twitter, actually they have a visual interface for users to create bots that tweet, retweet, like, and perform other actions on the social network. Has anybody ever created a bot or tried to? No? I think it'd be fun for one of my classes. I usually for cybercrime, if I teach it, I don't teach it anymore. I sometimes have my students do things like this, kind of crazy little things because, you know, anyway, so I might look at having students build bots just to try. Oh, you want to try right now? Okay. Well, you just go out there and you can learn how to create it, Josh. They don't seem too hard. Plus, you can copy and paste until you learn what's actually going on with it. But not all bots are bots. Bots are bad. Say that 10 times over. You know, a lot of things in the computer world and cyber, these were created, you know, either programs or, you know, some sort of utility and things like that. They were meant to be kind of good or kind of funny. But now anything that really has a good use in cyber also has the antithesis or the bad use. And that's with bots. Used to be that, and it still are, that you have a web crawler and chat bots. they're essential for helping, you know, the internet work properly. They can help get you going where you need to go, like with some sort of service request. I mean, I'm sure all of you have seen, I get frustrated with the bots. I have to be honest with you. If I'm like, say I'm Verizon and I know it's a bot, and then they say, oh, we have to get you to a real person. I'm like, just get me to a real person to start with. But you know, bots are supposed to be there to kind of direct you and maybe answer like, what hours are you open? And whatnot. So they were developed really to be kind of good, to help out. And then there's the bad bots. That's the ones that can take over to do a distributed denial of service. Because you can just hit all these bots that are hitting the computer and hitting the servers and things like that. And so they're not so good. And then you have other bots that are carrying out things behind the scenes, stealing data, causing other havoc on the computer. A lot of times, well, in the Estonia attack, that's what happened, is they had all these botnets that were just attacking the servers and then they took it down. You may have a bot on your computer right now and you don't, you know, you did some forensics, you could do some network analysis and look at the network traffic that's going over there and kind of go through your computer and see if there's a bot on there. Where was I? I heard somewhere about bots that were, they would be allowed into your computer to use your computing power, because, you know, you don't use all of your computing power. Well, most of you don't use all your computing power. And these bots would be in there and they'd be farming using this computing power, either to do some sort of to help with crypto mining or to help other organizations with computers. And in return, they would, you know, give you something back. And so there was supposed to be this thing out there where they would use these bots to try to utilize your excess computing power on your computer and whatnot. But I don't know if that's necessarily the case. It'd be interesting in a forensics class to go out there and really delve in and see who's got a bot on their system and not. Maybe I'll have to put that down for another class. I'm coming up with all these great ideas for future classes. So you'll have to stick with me and see if I ever come to fruition, right? We're building bots and doing forensics on bots and things like that. Anyway, so that's what a bot. Any questions on bots? Oh, yes. How they're used. Very good, Tyler. It's all in the motive, right? Well, the thing about bots in today, or previous to today, I guess today is kind of late, but they were, there's these election 2020. Yes, we are in that time. But there's this impact of bad bots on social media that are going out there and they're trying to get people to sway their opinions or, you know, flood the social media with, you know, whoever the candidate is at the time or whoever the candidate is that the bot wants you to get out and vote for. It happened back in 2016. The Russians were allegedly behind it, where they were sending out these bots and they would just flood the Twitters, Facebooks, and YouTube. Same things happen now. The social media companies are really trying to lock down on that using other sorts of, you know, like artificial intelligence to stop it. And they use chat captchas and things like that to make sure it's not a bot, but they're very prevalent. Okay. What was that, Jason? I just quickly looked at it. Can you pop up? Was that an article on the bots?
Oh, SETI at Home is a project where you could volunteer your unused computing resources to help scan for alien radio communications.
Oh, I'm going to do that definitely after class. I think I want to go find these aliens. I'm just kidding. That's cool. See, I told you that people want your extra computing power and they'll use bots to go in there and, you know, get it and do what they need to do with it. Anyway, that's cool. So anyway, the elections, trying to get people to sway their opinions using bots. So you can't get away from cyber and these bots and our political affiliations, right? So this article out of the Cybersecurity Magazine said bots drive 10 to 20% of the conversation on social media, particularly related to natural disasters, elections, and other loaded issues and events, AKA COVID-19. So I'm sure there's bots out there doing that. These are the actions of bot operators accessing fake profiles to sway public opinion at scale, try to scare people, all the scare tactics and stuff like that. And there's some AI that's artificial intelligence that's out there that's really trying to stop these bots. And you can read the whole thing if you want to there in the Security Magazine. All right. Questions, comments, concerns? let's talk about critical infrastructure. You're probably like, we already did the assignment. I know we already did the assignment. I'm sorry. So I didn't talk about these before, but you kind of already knew. I mean, on Thursday, I did mention them, these critical infrastructure sectors of the Department of Homeland Security. And those, the definition of that is just the assets, the systems, the networks, physical or virtual, that are just so vital to the United States. And that if something happened to them, they were incapacitated, they weren't able to be used or destroyed, they would have debilitating effect on national security, the economic security, political health, or public health, safety, or any combination thereof. So that's just an area that I think is needs some more attention. Here are the 16 sectors that you've seen. You read about these and you wrote about them. You have the chemical sector, you have commercial facilities, just a lot of different things that you might not have thought of. Today, I go in front of the ITAM department to get approval for my agribusiness class, which will tie into the critical infrastructure of food and agriculture. So that'll be an interesting class that I'll teach in the spring or summer, I guess. There's partnerships that have developed and are continuing to be nurtured. And this is where the Department of Homeland Security needs to work with private organizations as well as public organizations. It really just needs to be a good marrying of the two, because of so much can be shared from the private companies and all that, that I just think that it's important that these partnerships are forged and they continue to work together and not against each other. It's just because it is so important and a lot, and they're really tied. So that was just my point with the partnerships there. With more collaboration. So part of the critical infrastructure is nuclear power, things like that. And that's why I wanted to talk about SCADA and Stuxnets, I should say. And remember what SCADA stands for? Supervisory Control and Access Data, right? Or data access, data, supervisory control and data
Acquisition.
Thank you. I knew I was off by one. I always get that wrong. All right. So Stuxnets. This is one of my favorites to talk about. It was a malicious malware first uncovered in 2010 by Kaspersky Labs. They're out of Russia, if you haven't studied them at all. And you might want to for your cybersecurity company for this particular assignment for this week. That it was thought to have initially been developed in 2005. So it was, working its way through the different systems, and it was first uncovered in 2010. I'm going to show a video in a little bit. It's a 14-minute video, which I know is long for this class, but I love this video and I want to watch it again. So you get to watch it with me, unless of course you drop. But Stuxnets had two payloads, main payloads, this Siemens S7-315-2 PLC, which remember is the programmable logic controller. And then it had a man-in-the-middle attack on the PLC, which messed with the logic of that particular controller. So those are the two main payloads that were a man-in-the-middle attack, and it wanted to target that particular model of a PLC. It supposedly ruined almost one-fifth of Iran's nuclear centrifuges at Natanz. It was a zero-day exploit, which that's one of the areas I haven't really talked about, 0 days. It's brand new and there's nothing, your antivirus won't catch it. It's one of those that is so new on the mark, on the system, you just don't catch it. 0 days are pretty scary because you don't know exactly what they're going to do. So Stuxnets was pretty scary and it was considered a 0 day, and it was thought to self-destruct in 2012. So it was first developed probably around 2005, uncovered in 2010. But then when the engineers who studied the code for Stuxnets, they found out it was written in there to self-destruct in 2012. So what is it? It was a small program, about 15,000 lines of code. So not too big. It was distributed not through the internet. It wasn't somebody went out to some site and downloaded it. It was on thumb drives. And I know Tyler, I'm going to call you out here. I think you had used this in your supply chain malware, because it was one of those things where somebody probably went and scattered USB thumb drives on the in the parking lot at Natanz. And did you say something?
I said that was my logic about it, yeah.
That it was just kind of out there. And then people, I mean, they look at a thumb drive, they're like, I wonder what's on it. I wonder if there's anything really cool or any little, you know, pictures or recipes or anything that could be kind of, has anybody ever, be honest, picked up a thumb drive and said, I'm going to put it in my computer. Try it. Jason, good job. Was there anything cool on it? Yeah. No way, Steve. I didn't think so. It was funny when I was talking to my friend, she works at CW, but she's over at Sammamish. And she does a lot of the interaction between like industry, Microsoft, and she had a meeting with Microsoft, and she was in the parking lot and she found a USB and she took it in and gave it to this person in Microsoft in Redmond in the campus over there and said, I just found this in the parking lot. He goes, oh, let me see what's on it. I kid you not. I lie to you not. She goes, don't do that. He goes, oh no, it's fine. I'm like, that's not the best, you know, do as I say, not as I do, something like that. Anyway, I just thought that was crazy. But that's what happened with StuckNet. Somebody found it, and then they plugged it in thinking they were going to find something really cool, and then all heck broke loose, right? And it was not, you know, it was not out there to try to steal money. It was not looking for stealing identities. It was looking for that Siemens programmable logic controller. I didn't see the comment. I'll get to it in just a second. And it was only designed to hit there at Natanz. That is I just think that's so cool. So, you know, I cannot say it as eloquently as this YouTube video, and that's why I'm going to switch over to that. Let me see. Tyler, in high school, I met a guy who was smart enough not to use a personal PC, but not smart enough to avoid using a school PC. Ah, so they found him, huh? All right.
Fortunately, nothing happened to the school's network, but it was still a pretty stupid situation.
Yeah. Because, well, before, okay, so USBs used to be more money, right? They used to be not, now you can go to any sort of trade show or any of that, they give you those, although I'd be leery of those. I like to use them for forensic stuff, but, you know, they were more expensive when they first came out. Now they're pretty cheap, but anyway, so people are like, oh, I can use this for my stuff. Anyway. Let's go out to, oh, I gotta do my special thing. There we go. Here we go. 14 minutes and 54 seconds. If you wanna go get a cup of coffee, go get a cup of coffee, but this is a really good video, I think.
The past few months now, the nation's top military, intelligence, and law enforcement officials have been warning Congress and the country about a coming cyber attack against critical infrastructure in the United States that could affect everything from the heat in your home to the money in your bank account. The warnings have been raised before, but never with such urgency, because this new era of warfare has already begun. The first attack using a computer virus called Stuxnet was launched several years ago against an Iranian nuclear facility, almost certainly with some U.S. involvement. But the implications and the possible consequences are only now coming to light.
The story will continue in a moment.
I do believe that the cyber threat will equal or surpass the threat from counterterrorism in the foreseeable future.
There's a strong likelihood that the next Pearl Harbor that we confront could very well be a cyber attack.
We will suffer a catastrophic cyber attack. The clock is ticking.
And there's reason for concern. For more than a decade, the U.S. military establishment has treated cyberspace as a domain of conflict, where it would need the capability to fend off attack or launch its own. That time is here because someone sabotaged a top-secret nuclear installation in Iran with nothing more than a long string of computer code.
We have entered into a new phase of conflict in which we use a cyber weapon to create physical destruction. And in this case, physical destruction and someone else's critical infrastructure.
Few people know more about the dark military art of cyber war than retired General Michael Hayden. He's a former head of the National Security Agency and was CIA director under George W. Bush. He knows a lot more about the attack on Iran than he can say here.
This was a good idea, all right? But I also admit, this was a really big idea, too. The rest of the world is looking at this and saying, clearly someone has legitimated this kind of activity as acceptable international conduct. The whole world is watching.
The story of what we know about the Stuxnet virus begins in June of 2010, when it was first detected and isolated by a tiny company in Belarus after one of its clients in Iran complained about a software glitch. Within a month, a copy of the computer bug was being analyzed within a tight-knit community of computer security experts, and it immediately grabbed the attention of Liam Omerku, an operations manager for Symantec, one of the largest antivirus companies in the world.
As soon as we saw it, we knew it was something completely different, and red flags started to go up straight away.
To begin with, Stuxnet was incredibly complicated and sophisticated, beyond the cutting edge. It had been out in the wild for a year without drawing anyone's attention and seemed to spread by way of USB thumb drives, not over the internet. Omerku's job was to try and unlock its secrets and assess the threat for Symantec's clients by figuring out what the malicious software was engineered to do and who was behind it.
How long was the Stuxnet code?
You're talking tens of thousands of lines of code. A very, very long project, very well written, very professionally written, and very difficult to analyze.
Unlike the millions of worms and viruses that turn up on the internet every year, this one was not trying to steal passwords, identities, or money. Stuxnet appeared to be crawling around the world, computer by computer, looking for some sort of industrial operation that was using a specific piece of equipment, a Siemens S7300 programmable logic controller.
This gray box here is essentially what runs factory floors. And you program this box to control your equipment. Then you say, turn on a conveyor belt, turn on a heater, turn on a cooler, shut the plant down. It's all contained in that box. And that's what Stuxnet was looking for. It wanted to get its malicious code onto that box.
The programmable logic controller, or PLC, is one of the most critical pieces of technology you've never heard of. They contain circuitry and software essential for modern life and control the machines that run traffic lights, assembly lines, oil and gas pipelines, not to mention water treatment facilities, electric companies, and nuclear power plants.
And that was very worrying to us because we thought it could have been a water treatment facility here in the U.S. or it could have been trying to take down electricity plants here in the U.S.
The first breakthrough came when Omerku and his five-man team discovered that Stuxnet was programmed to collect information every time it infected a computer and to send it on to two websites in Denmark and Malaysia. Both had been registered with a stolen credit card and the operators were nowhere to be found, but Omerku was able to monitor the communications.
Well, the first thing we did was we looked at where the infections were occurring in the world and we mapped them out. And that's what we see here. We saw that 70% of the infections occurred in Iran. That's very unusual for malware that we see. We don't normally see high infections in Iran.
Please learn from Stuxnet.
2 months later, Ralph Langner, a German expert on industrial control systems, added another piece of important information. Stuxnet didn't attack every computer it infected.
This whole virus is designed only to hit one specific target in the world.
How could you tell that?
It goes through a sequence of checks to actually determine if this is the right target. It's kind of a fingerprinting process, a process of probing if this is the target I'm looking for, and if not, it just leaves the controller alone.
Stuxnet wasn't just looking for a Siemens controller that ran a factory floor, it was looking for a specific factory floor with a specific type and configuration of equipment, including Iranian components that weren't used anywhere else in the world, and variable speed motors that might be used to regulate spinning centrifuges, a fragile piece of equipment essential to the enrichment of uranium. And Langer speculated publicly that Stuxnet was out to sabotage Iran's nuclear program.
We knew at this time that the highest number of infections had been reported in Iran. And second, was pretty clear just by looking at the sophistication that there would be at least one nation state behind this. And now you just add one and one together.
By the fall of 2010, the consensus was that Iran's top secret uranium enrichment plant in Natanz was the target, and that Stuxnet was a carefully constructed weapon designed to be carried into the plant on a corrupted laptop or thumb drive, then infect the system, disguise its presence, move through the network changing computer code, and subtly alter the speed of the centrifuges without the Iranians ever noticing. Sabotage by software.
Stuxnet's entire purpose is to control centrifuges, to make centrifuges speed up past what they're meant to spin at, and to damage them. Certainly, it would damage the uranium enrichment facility, and they would need to be replaced.
If the centrifuges were spinning too fast, wouldn't the operators at the plant know that?
Stuxnet was able to prevent the operators from seeing that on their screen. The operators would look at the screen to see what's happening with centrifuges, and they wouldn't see that anything bad was happening.
It now seems likely that by the time Omerku and Langner finally unraveled the mystery in November of 2010, Stuxnet had already accomplished at least part of its mission. Months before the virus was first detected, inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency had begun to notice that Iran was having serious problems with its centrifuges at Natanz.
What we know is that an IAEA report said that 1,000 to 2,000 centrifuges were removed from Natanz for unknown reasons. And we know that Stuxnet targets 1,000 centrifuges. So from that, people are drawing to conclusion, well, Stuxnet got in and succeeded. That's the only evidence that we have.
The only information that's not classified.
Yes.
And there are lots of things about Stuxnet that are still top secret.
Who was behind it?
What we do know is that this was a very large operation. You're really looking at a government agency from some country who's politically motivated and who has the insider information from a uranium enrichment facility that would facilitate building a threat like this.
An intelligence agency, probably.
Probably.
We know from reverse engineering the attack code that the attackers have full, and I mean this literally, full technical knowledge of every damn detail of this plant. So you could say, in a way, they know the plant better than the Iranian operator.
We wanted to know what retired General Michael Hayden had to say about all this, since he was the CIA director at the time Stuxnet would have been developed.
You left the CIA in 2009?
2009, right.
Does this surprise you that this happened?
You need to separate my experience at CIA with your question.
Right.
All right?
You can't talk about the CIA.
No, and I don't even want to suggest what may have been on the horizon or not on the horizon or anything like
right.
that.
Right. If you look at the countries that have the capability of designing something like Stuxnet, and you take a look at the countries that would have a motive for trying right. to destroy Natanz.
Where do those two sets intersect?
You're pretty much left with the United States and Israel.
Well, yes, but there is no good with someone of my background even speculating on that question, so I won't.
Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, shown here at Natanz in 2008, blamed the cyber attack on enemies of the state and downplayed the damage. Both the U.S. and Israel maintain that it set back the Iranian program by several years. What's impossible to know is how much damage the attackers might have inflicted if the virus had gone undetected and not been exposed by computer security companies trying to protect their customers.
They planned to stay in that plant for many years and to do the whole attack in a completely covert manner, that any time centrifuges would break, the operators would think, this is again a technical problem that we have experienced, for example, because of poor quality of the centrifuges that we were using.
We had a good idea that this was a blown operation, something that was never meant to be seen. It was never meant to come to the public's attention.
You say blown, meaning?
If you're running an operation like this to sabotage a uranium enrichment facility, you don't want the code uncovered. You want it kept secret. You want it just to keep working, stay undercover, do its damage, and disappear, and hopefully nobody would ever see it.
Do you think this was a blown operation?
No, not at all. I think it's an incredibly sophisticated operation.
But General Hayden did acknowledge that there are all sorts of potential problems and possible consequences that come with this new form of warfare.
When you use a physical weapon, it destroys itself, in addition to the target, if it's used properly. Cyber weapon doesn't. So there are those out there who can take a look at this, study it, and maybe even attempt to turn it to their own purposes.
Such as launching a cyber attack against critical infrastructure here in the United States. Until last fall, Sean McGurk was in charge of protecting it as head of cyber defense at the Department of Homeland Security. He believes that Stuxnet has given countries like Russia and China, not to mention terrorist groups and gangs of cyber criminals for hire, a textbook on how to attack key U.S. installations.
You can download the actual source code of Stuxnet now, and you can repurpose it and repackage it and then, you know, point it back towards wherever it came from.
Sounds a little bit like Pandora's box.
Yes.
Whoever launched this attack,
they opened up the box, they demonstrated the capability, they showed the ability and the desire to do so, and it's not something that can be put back.
If somebody in the government had come to you and said, look, we're thinking about doing this, what do you think? What would you have told them?
I would have strongly cautioned them against it because of the unintended consequences of releasing such a code.
Meaning that other people could use it against you?
Yes.
Or use their own version of the code?
Something similar. Son of Stuxnet, if you will.
As a result, what was once abstract theory has now become a distinct possibility.
If you can do this to a uranium enrichment plant, why couldn't you do it to a nuclear power reactor in the United States or an electric company?
You could do that to those facilities. It's not easy. It's a difficult task, and that's why Stuxnet was so sophisticated. But it could be done.
You don't need many billions, you just need a couple of millions. And this would buy you a decent cyber attack, for example, against the U.S. power grid.
If you were a terrorist group or a failed nation state and you had a couple of million dollars, where would you go to find the people that knew how to do this?
On the internet.
They're out there?
Sure.
Most of the nation's critical infrastructure is privately owned and extremely vulnerable to a highly sophisticated cyber weapon like Stuxnet.
I can't think of another area in Homeland Security where the threat is greater and we've done less.
After several failures, Congress is once again trying to pass the nation's first cybersecurity law. And once again, there is fierce debate over whether the federal government should be allowed to require the owners of critical infrastructure to improve the security of their computer networks. Whatever the outcome, no one can say the nation hasn't been warned.
So what do you think? Do I have some? I still have some students. Did you like that?
I enjoyed the video a lot.
Yeah, I liked it.
Yeah.
He answered the question I was going to type out at the end, which was, could someone reverse engineer or even modify Stuxnet to basically target anything that they wanted to?
That's a fear, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then, or you could just hire somebody off the dark web to do it for you.
Not a very long
there's some of the
either.
Yes, Steve, we're all doomed. No, come on, that's why we're hiring. That's why you guys are learning this. Anyway, I'm sorry, I cut somebody off. Jason?
What are some of the main arguments against the government requiring better security at critical infrastructure sites?
So what are some arguments against?
Yeah.
I don't know why you would want arguments against it. I would want full, you know, blown cyber protection on all the critical infrastructure.
I would think so too. It just seemed like at the end of that video, Congress keeps trying, but there's pushback. And I was wondering what that pushback is. Just who's going to absorb the cost?
Steve's got it. It's the money.
Yeah.
It's that. And Jason, you know this from probably your time in the Army. You have these older antiquated systems that are still running factories. I mean, they're trying to do the, what's it like, chicken wire and Bondo to put something new to something old, mm-hmm. older. And like I mentioned on Thursday, there's still a lot of old programming languages and they haven't come up to speed. So that's where, but that takes a lot of money and not so much money. And coming from the military is, you know, we were trying to put new avionics systems and new weapon systems on a B-52. B-52s were used in Vietnam.
Right.
And so you have that kind of technology gap that you have to somehow seem, you know, kind of weave it together. And that's what takes a lot of time and money. And it's not that people don't want to do it. I don't think that's it. I think everybody's for it. Yeah, because we all benefit from electricity, wastewater, and all these critical infrastructure, our needs. It's just, it's so vast because it, you know, it's such, you have such old stuff trying to tie it into new stuff because you want to make it automated. I mean, it's an incredible feat, but I think if you have any inclination for my class, you know, to do something like this, I think it's a wonderful area to go into. Other questions?
Just a comment. As far as reasons not to, the only reason I can think of would be like the ideological small government, you know, keep government out of people's business. But especially in cybersecurity, that strikes me as an antiquated way of going about things and also a really short-sighted way of going about things, because most people still underestimate the danger of getting hacked. And a lot of companies, they're going to look at how expensive putting these defenses in place are and not do them. And then they're going to get hacked. And then the people, their clients, are going to suffer because their clients are going to have their data harvested.
That's why when you do risk assessments, when you're in that, you have to convince the money bags of the organization and the CEO that it is worth it, because the second and third order of effects that they won't see. Right now, they see a huge probably price tag to hire CrowdStrike or hire Cloudflare or do something. And they don't say, what's our ROI, return on investment on this? We don't see it right away. But you have to be able to convince them that, well, you know, you don't want a target, do you? You don't want a target attack where you're paying all this and your name, your reputation. And that's what you'll learn in risk assessment when you get to 438, all about that. There was one other thing I was going to... Go ahead, Tyler.
Just one final comment on the why someone wouldn't upgrade is people also really do not like change. So if someone's had this plan forever and you're trying to go and upgrade their security, and that might mean new practices, then you might encounter a lot of pushback from someone just not wanting to change things.
Yep, you always have that. People are resistant to change. And why do I have to log in like this? Or why do I have to log in with my phone and this password, or things like that? So there are reasons, but that was good conversation. I'm gonna switch back to the slides and we'll finish up here. I have a comment, let's see. Oh, okay. Let's see what else we want to talk about. So just kind of what Washington State is doing to protect critical infrastructure. They actually, I think I mentioned this on Thursday, they've published this security guide for the state of Washington critical infrastructure. You can go download it if you want to. They're one of, not all states have done this, but Washington has really tried to put a lot of emphasis on this critical infrastructure. And then also the NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, developed a framework in response to a presidential order to improve critical infrastructure cybersecurity. So, you know, there are things that are out there. It seems slow at times, and I think it's the cost, getting people to change their ways and things like that. But we are working towards that. I just wanted you all to know that because I think it's such a great area to go into. And just a couple more, size matters. And what I was getting with on this slide is, you know, there's been more attacks on critical infrastructure. Anytime I hear of a power outage, say down in California, or they have these brownouts and things like that, I'm always thinking, could this be a, you know, a cyber attack? Could somebody else be doing something, another Stuxnet or an attack on SCADA? And it very well could be. And the reason I talk about size matters is because an adversary or a bad actor or somebody, let's try to go at the weakest link. Let's try to go at that little wastewater treatment plant in Ellensburg. And you're like, well, you know, that they're going to take out the wastewater treatment plant. Yes, that will affect people here in Ellensburg and whatnot in the city. But the bottom line is they'll be gaining knowledge. Oh, this is how we break into this one. You know, kind of like you pick a lock. You start early when you're a kid. You know, if you're going to be a bad kid and you pick locks or you do those kinds of things, and then you grow up to, okay, I'm going to pick this lock, or I'm going to blow up this. I mean, it can escalate by just learning about how things are run in small rural utility companies and things like that. And then after that, with the help of the internet and the code that's written out there, these attacks could then escalate. And I know I put all these things. I gave this presentation to a group out in Wenatchee who was, there was a lot of actual people in critical infrastructure and their eyes were this big when I was done with them. But so we need to do more. And I think I've kind of already hit that for you. But the reason I wanted to share with you is you will get to do some of this in your time here at CWU once you get to IT 482, the capstone class. And I'll just skip down to the bottom. It's that Pisces project that all students who are go through the capstone get to actually monitor traffic that's it's running between municipalities. I'll just go to the next slide to talk about it. It's so say Ellensburg, this the county of Kittitas, Clee Ellum, there's Burling, Burien, Covington, some other smaller or not real small cities over on the west side are all part of this public infrastructure security cyber education system, which is a nonprofit organization. It was developed by CI Security and other folks in the government here in Washington to say, we don't have enough manpower and person power in these critical areas. We don't have them, you know, we don't have somebody with a lot of experience maybe doing IT and wastewater or this, that, and the other thing. Why don't we look at these colleges and universities and see how can we, you know, leverage the students to monitor traffic to see if there's anything bad going on? And that's what this whole project is about. So you're monitoring logs, you're watching it, you're looking at it to see if there's any sort of possible attack. What there's some, you know, they found some law enforcement. They were gaming and downloading pornography and things like that. But students found this. And I just think this is a great program. We have a great relationship with Western Washington University because they started it. And we said, we want to be part of this as well. Because not only do you, as the student in this class, get the opportunity to monitor the traffic of this critical infrastructure, you get to put it on your resume that says, I actually monitored log data or log traffic or network traffic for, you know, umpteen hours. And you get to put that down as real world experience. So this is kind of your start to see if this is something that really interests you once you get to 482. And of course, you know, I have to put a plug in for it, but I think you're really going to enjoy it. It's using Kibana. Maybe some of you have seen it or used the Kibana platform. Basically, it's a huge search engine pulling data from different sensors out at these different municipalities and cities and things like that. And then you're actually putting together a dashboard. And then if you find something, you write a ticket using the Mantis BT bug tracking ticket software, and you get that. And so I think it's awesome. That's why I kind of wanted to end this lesson on that, because kind of just, I think it gets me excited. I get to teach it, so I get to learn it better myself. And then you know, like I said, you get to experience it as well. Once you get to 482, I'm trying to get it maybe into the club and some of the other places, because they really need more, you know, eyes on it all the time, not just when, you know, class is in session. We have schools in Idaho now are doing it. Spokane Valley Community College, I think Pierce Community College, us, Western Washington, and more are getting, they're starting to actually go outside of Washington, like I said, to Idaho. I think Alabama wants to start it in their area. So this is a big deal. Anyway, questions on that? You should all be excited for doing working through Pisces when you get to 482. And the last thing is you can watch Zero Days. There's a movie on Zero Days, which is supposedly Stuxnet. There's a book out there too about it that you can read. But that's what I had for today. Any other comments or questions? Gripes, complaints? Keep those to yourself. I'm just kidding.
Pisces sounds interesting. This is actually the first I've ever heard of the program.
The Pisces program?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I try to bring it into this class, because this is really your introduction into cybersecurity. And I kind of, it's one of those things where I'm trying to figure out where I can do more with the Pisces and and not wait till the capstone. Maybe the capstone, you do something else with it, but you can start monitoring traffic now. Because I think some of you might be want to do that. You know, you might want to work for CI Security. Heck, they have an office right there whereby, you know, where the old Copper Kettle restaurant, you might, for those that are familiar with town, it's kind of back there. There was a party store. It took over the party store. And now there's a law office in front of it. It's right there off of Main. It's right there. They're doing that for real. I mean, when I say for real, they're doing it for paid customers. This isn't paid. This is a kind of a philanthropic thing that Mike Hamilton, he started it with the help of the Fusion Center, the Cyber Fusion Center, and some of the other folks in the cyber division for the state of Washington. So Mike Hamilton is one that if you haven't followed him or haven't heard his name and you want to start following, just follow him on LinkedIn. He does a lot of podcasts every week. He's on there and just he's helped a lot of students at CW get jobs.
Okay. Then sorry, one more time. What was his name?
Mike Hamilton.
Mike Hamilton.
Yeah. Are you LinkedIn with me? You have LinkedIn?
I'm not on LinkedIn.
If you link in with me, then he's there.
Okay. Mike Hamilton. Cool.
But anyway, hopefully you have a great rest of your day. You can think of some more things that are going on in cyber, a different aspect of cyber that you hadn't thought of before. And then next week we'll go into, like I said, some cryptocurrency, some dark web kind of stuff, and maybe IoT, because there's a problem with IoT and cybersecurity. You have smart light bulbs, but yet they could be a potential vector for an attack.
All right. Sounds like a plan.